The drought will reduce the country's hydropower output by 60% by the end of this year.
The problems are multiple, and we will not only face the energy crunch and the water shortage, but also the financial turmoil that will inevitably hit the international markets. Let's sit tight, because a financial shock is on the way, and it will start from the US as usual.
Lately, Prime Minister Draghi has been facing problems protecting the government coalition that supports him. A rift has opened up with former Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte. Also, former Deputy Prime Minister Matteo Salvini has reportedly taken up arms against the executive. A government collapse at this very stage could have grave repercussions for Italy's social stability. Max Civili, Rome.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian has met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. They discussed cooperation relations, in which Assad described ties between both states as an alliance of will in the face of Western hegemony. During the meeting, the Syrian president touched upon the threats of Turkey to launch a new offensive in Syria. Assad said Turkish pretexts for an aggression on Syria are false, misleading, and disconnected from reality, stressing that they violate the UN Charter and international law. Amir Abdullahian said Assad's recent visit to Tehran constituted a turning point in Syrian-Iranian relations. He added that Israeli attacks on Syria are part of the terrorist war on the country. The top Iranian official noted that Iran is ready to help settle misunderstandings between Damascus and Ankara.
Any foreign intervention in Syria complicates the situation. We understand Turkish concerns over border issues. The solution lies in dialogue between Syrian and Turkish security officials. I understand from my talks with the Turks that they prioritize a political solution.
Amir Abdullahian also had a separate meeting with his Syrian counterpart Faisal al-Maqdad. He expressed optimism over solving the Turkish-Syrian conflict peacefully, asserting Iran will exert all efforts to prevent any conflict in Syria. Maqdad welcomed Iran's efforts.
Any solution that leads to Turkey's retreat from Syrian territories, stopping its attacks on the country, and ending Turkey's support to terrorist groups is welcomed. We trust the Islamic Republic of Iran, but not the other side.
Miqdad reiterated Syria's determination to eliminate terrorism and thanked Iran for its support. He stressed that Israel must realize that Syria will not remain silent over Israeli aggressions. The visit shows the depth of ties between the two allies and the crucial role Iran plays in the region, as it comes hours after an Israeli attack on Syria and amid speculations that Turkey is going to launch a military operation in the Arab country. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
The town of Alamskia. 8 years of war have left their mark. The streets are eerily deserted as the front line is close. The cultural center was hit a few days ago. It now serves as the town hall. From inside, I am pointed out a Russian monument. While I'm filming, the boom of outgoing artillery. Two people were killed at the monument this week. The building, like the streets outside, feels like a ghost town. But inside, I find Elena, the head of the council administration.
People run quickly to the shops, buy what they need, and run home. People are simply afraid of going out. I can't say how people live in the west of Ukraine, but this is how we live here. We hope for peace soon, so we can start to rebuild the town.
The school has been hit many times, as is the market and the hospital.
Now, while elsewhere in Ukraine, it's very easy to level the accusations that Ukraine is shelling civilians and civilian areas, here in this town, it's a little bit harder to do so because, frankly, the front line is only around 50 meters or 100 meters around this town, and there's the almost constant sound of outgoing artillery as well. So Ukrainians may well just be trying to hit these artillery pieces rather than just aiming at civilians.
Incredibly, in this desolate place, some civilians still live here, although most cower inside.
So what is it like to live here?
It's bad, my nerves are shredded, and it's always tense. What kind of a state is Ukraine that kills its own people, sending brother against brother? We are hoping soon for victory.
In the adjacent city of Golovka, I meet the well-known mayor, Ivan Pekotko. He uses a Ukrainian flag as the doormat to his office.
This flag lying over there symbolizes the criminal state of Ukraine, not its people. The flag is my personal trophy as well. I took it at the front line. I was born in Donetsk and I loved Ukraine. But those who took power in 2014 in the coup trampled over democracy, and they do not care about the citizens of the East.
Who do you blame for the breakup of Ukraine?
The answer is obvious. NATO countries are to blame, in particular the United States. They needed Ukraine as a hotbed of tension at the border with Russia. You see, I'm for democracy. In 2014, they should have asked what people wanted. But nobody was interested in people's opinion. That's why we have got what we have now. We have a terrible war, dead Ukrainians, dead Russians. It's really horrible. And those who draw benefit from it are sitting across the ocean.
While Russia calls this war a special military operation, Ukraine calls it an invasion. But here in Donbass, the pro-Russian civilians call it a liberation operation. With the Russian army making gains not far to the north of these desperate streets, the 8 years of war in this town might finally be set to end. Jenny Milik-Golovka.
British Premier League football team Tottenham Hotspurs have come under fire ahead of a pre-season friendly match. The fixture, pitting Tottenham against Italian side AS Roma, scheduled in Haifa on July the 30th, has been condemned as an attempt to normalise crimes against Palestinians by critics.
The fans especially, amongst whom are many people of Muslim background or of ethnic minorities, they will be big supporters of the Palestinians, but the team going out there is a slap in the face for them.
The London-based Human Rights Commission launched a letter campaign encouraging supporters to write to Tottenham and demand the club cancel the controversial fixture. Elsewhere, pro-Palestine supporters condemned the fixture online.
We have an epidemic of Russophobia in this country and across the whole of the West, but there is no similar attempt to hold Israel to account for its crimes. 74 years since Israel was created out of the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians, people who are still refugees with no home to go to.
Israel has been recognized by Amnesty International as an apartheid regime. Their crimes have been well documented for many years. Just days prior to Tottenham announcing the fixture, international outrage was sparked over the slaying of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akhileh. Tottenham have so far not commented on any of the criticism, but they did announce last May that they were delighted with their planned tour of Israel. This suggests that perhaps Tottenham Hotspurs is not as concerned about human rights abuses as perhaps they should be. Robert Carter, London.
As hundreds of thousands of Muslims embark upon a pilgrimage to the Holy Kaaba in Mecca, they must enter a particular state of purification and sanctity known as the Ihram. In Arabic, Ihram means prohibition and a state of holiness.
Ihram and Miqat are like a runway for planes. If one wants to ascend, he'd better use this runway. You can't do it from anywhere else.
Ihram is an obligatory prerequisite to Hajj. Muslims stop at a designated station to perform the rituals associated with wearing ihram. The stations of Miqat are the five prescribed places for ihram, located at different directional corners from the holy city of Mecca, Saudi Arabia. Pilgrims perform ablution and cleanse their bodies. Then they wear ihram and make niyat, the intention of performing hajj. Men are required to wear two pieces of white cloth that are unadorned and plain. Women are not required to conform to a specific dress code, but have to dress modestly. It is crucial to ensure that the clothes are neat and tidy.
In addition to its facade, Hajj has an essence. We must find out the essence of the act of wearing ihram. This attire signifies the removal of any impurity or unclean aspect from our body and soul.
We wear ihram to abstain from sins we have committed in the past and get closer to God. After wearing ihram, Muslims are prohibited from a number of acts.
Ihram also resembles the shroud used to wrap dead bodies before they are buried. Therefore, it's a reminder of how death comes unannounced and does not discriminate between anyone.
There are different stages in Hajj that are like wake-up calls for us in our lives. Ihram reminds us of the afterlife and that our existence would not perish after death.
After cleansing their bodies and wearing ihram, Muslims get ready for the journey to the holy city of Mecca and they will visit Kaaba. Mahdi Abbasian, Medina.
A perfect storm is brewing for Italy's economy, just as the country was beginning to see the light at the end of the tunnel after getting badly hurt during the pandemic. A combination of more unexpected shocks is threatening its stability. The energy crunch due to the Ukraine crisis, the subsequent energy price spikes and rising interest rates are threatening to put Italy's economy on the ropes.
Confidence has diminished considerably in Italy, with consumers and companies seeing a less positive future. Households are increasingly feeling the brunt of the inflation that has risen to nearly 7%, the highest level in over two decades.
Analysts are saying that Italy's economy could contract further if Russia, after reducing gas supply by 40%, decides to stop the flow of gas altogether. A total halt in supply could trigger company shutdowns and layoffs. Numerous protests have been staged across the country over the past weeks amidst growing skepticism toward the government. As the European Central Bank is expected to adopt higher interest rates to counter the Eurozone's growing inflation, conditions of living are expected to worsen in Italy and across the old continent. Many fear this deteriorating scenario is likely to lead to a hot autumn of protests. Max Civili, Rome.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
It takes one gunshot to kill a person, if that is the intention, but not in the case of Jaylen Walker. 60 shots were fired at him by the police, and this after he fled a traffic stop. And all it took was showing that video, which brought out many in protest of an all too often repeated scene of police brutality, especially against African Americans. In this edition of The Spotlight, we'll look at why U.S. police violence and discrimination remains a problem in the U.S., a trend that does not show any signs of decreasing. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Professor of African American Studies and Anthropology at the University of Maryland, Joseph Richardson, joins us from Laurel, Maryland. Also, editor of the Pan-African Newswire, Abiyomi Azikiwe, joins us from Detroit.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Abiyomi Azikiwe, first to you, U.S. police, to have released that video, which was quite shocking in many sense of the word, which ended in this black man being shot and hit more than 60 times by officers that were pursuing him. What was your reaction upon the story then seeing the video?
It was shocking. However, at the same time, it was not surprising. The police have not let up on their brutal behavior, particularly towards the African-American people. This is over 2 years since we witnessed all across the world the brutal execution of George Floyd in Minneapolis, and in the aftermath of that, as well as the brutal murder of Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, by white vigilantes, the whole world exploded. Millions of people went into the streets across the United States, Europe, and other parts of the world. Yet, even though a new administration has been elected in the United States, at the State of the Union address, President Biden declared publicly that he was against any defunding or restructuring of the police, that he wanted more funding for the police for training. Training to do what is the question? To become more proficient in mass killings of African-American people. This is outrageous. And neither political party, the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, has put forward any program to curtail the violence that exists in the United States, whether it's police violence or state violence against the people or the mass killings that we see on a daily basis across the country. So the country is really coming apart at the seams due to the failure of leadership inside the United States.
Well, when we take a look at the mere fact that 60 shots were fired, Joseph Richardson, at this Jaylen Walker, is there a point, I'm just curious, I mean, we could break this down in terms of the logic or lack of it in terms from the point of view of the police officers, but I'm wondering why that excessive number. I mean, why at what point did they think they need to just keep on pushing the barrel and killing this person, or what happened? What train of thought could have gone through their minds when they're firing all these shots to amount to 60?
There is nothing that can explain it. And in fact, just in terms of what we've seen in the past with officers who have fired excessively at Black Americans in this country, it's far beyond just being excessive to literally just a massacre. And those were 60 shots that hit Jaylen Walker. It was actually, if you listen to the reports by the chief of police and Mr. Walker's family attorney, there were more than 95 shots. So we've seen this excessive amount of shootings in the past before, and there's nothing that could clearly explain it, with the exception of, one, the lack of training, but also just in terms of the level of racism that we see in this country, where Black lives do not matter, would, in my estimation, be an explanation for it. There's nothing else that could explain the police firing more than 95 shots at any human being and striking that person 60 times. And then it still has not been proven forensically whether Jaylen Walker actually shot at the police, and even if he had done that. We've seen in mass shootings across this country, in Buffalo, in Uvalde, we've seen perpetrators engaged in heinous crimes and shootings that have been able to leave those situations unscathed. So you have to, the police are trained to deal with certain individuals in certain situations, but when the color of the skin of that person happens to be Black, the outcome is quite different.
Well, first of all, both of you have talked about training in your statements, and then the whole notion of racism, that's the another part to this. But quite interestingly, I'd like to find out from you if you were aware of this, Abiyomi Ezekiwi, that based on numerous reports that was researched for this, that law enforcement and experts in police law who saw this body cam footage have said about the shooting that the officer's response actually reflects standard police training, which was quite surprising. And one of them said officers are trained to shoot until the threat they perceive and or reasonably believe is present has ended. And to add further injury to this, legally the number of shots does not matter in such cases. The U.S. Supreme Court has agreed that under the Fourth Amendment, if officers are justified in firing at a suspect in order to end a severe threat to public safety, they need not stop shooting until the threat has ended. Do you think that that's hitting the bullseye here in terms of what we're looking at?
Obviously, they are trained to kill, not to disarm, not to de-escalate the situation, but to kill. definitively killed, and this is what they've done in so many different occasions. And the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution ostensibly is supposed to protect people from unjustified search and seizure. It does not justify the killing of civilians by law enforcement. The reality is that this was a traffic stop. They claim he fired a weapon at the police. As my other colleague said, that's questionable at this point. And he was not armed at the time. He was fleeing from the police because he knew his life was in serious danger. And he was gunned down, shot dozens of times. So obviously this is routine practice. It's what the police are trained to do, and that is to kill African people. And they've been doing it for centuries now.
Right.
In a suburb right outside of Detroit, where I'm broadcasting from, they were using black people as target practice to train law enforcement officers. So this is a part of the repressive culture of the United States.
Well, why aren't there any motions to change this? Because this is obviously one of the things that's at the heart of the matter here, if you agree, Joseph Richardson.
I mean, I think from the ground, there have been motions to change it. We've seen the protests throughout the past decades. You know, I can think back to the shooting of Amadou Diallo in New York City. So there has always been the pressure on police departments around the country to change their approaches in terms of how they police black communities. And this goes beyond just police shootings. We can talk about in terms of just the disproportionate number of people who are black who are stopped and frisked every day if we really want to talk about Fourth Amendment rights. So the pressure has been on, but the political will, for example, to hold police liable in terms of even in terms of civil suits, that has not happened. So we need to be pushing on the gas in terms of police policies in this country. But again, the political will of our politicians and our presidents clearly is not there, because we just recently had President Biden say that he was actually going to increase the funding for the police. And so in terms of prosecuting the police, we haven't seen from a prosecutorial standpoint the police being implicated and charged at the fullest extent of the law for engaging in the heinous violence that they commit in the streets of this country among black Americans. And until we have that kind of rigorous prosecution of police officers with serious jail time and implications that are both criminal and civil, I don't think it's ever going to change.
Well, why is it that then police are treating black people this way? The system, some are saying, wasn't really even built to protect black people, and that discrimination emanates from that, and that the root cause of police and police brutality, in a sense, is the way that police treat black folks versus white folks is different. That doesn't sound like you have some kind of training course that you can have the police go through in order to learn that. So what approach can be used?
That's correct, because the origin of policing and police culture in the United States is heavily related to the history of enslavement of African people, the forced removal and genocide of indigenous people in the United States. That is the origins of the police as well as the military forces in the United States. So you have to, in a sense, obliterate that cultural legacy. And there's no way around the question and the demands to defund the police, to dismantle the law enforcement structures and culture that are pervasive in the United States. In order to do that, there has to be structural changes in the entire governance of the United States. I don't think this can be talked away. I believe that both political parties across the United States support the police. They have not been able in the U.S. Congress, despite the fact that there is a Democratic majority in the House of Representatives. The Senate is split 50-50, with the Vice President being the President of the Senate, who could break any tie within the Senate. They have been incapable of passing the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act and other measures that would ostensibly curb police misconduct and brutality against African-American people and all people in the United States, because it is so rooted in the class structure and the overall oppressive apparatus of the United States. So the whole system, in my opinion, has to change in order for there to be even a minuscule amount of improvement in regard to police-community relations.
One of the things that struck out in terms of the social media reaction that I'd like to get your reaction on this, Joseph Richardson, is how one person said, you know, they talk about how they need training. That's a narrative that, he said, makes white folks feel good because it excuses their biases. But he said there has to be a cultural shift, according to this point of view, from the warrior versus them mentality to more of a guardian mentality, according to this particular person. Do you agree with that?
I agree that we need to totally dismantle law enforcement in the way that we see it today. And tinkering around the edges with police reform will not achieve our goals. And so we need to take a serious look at how we arrived at this point, which we know started in, as my colleague mentioned, in the history, embedded in the history, in the legacy of slavery, which still exists in our country, embedded in the 13th Amendment. And we need to take a serious look at how we can deconstruct the police as we know it, and law enforcement and the criminal justice system as we know it, and begin to reframe an entirely new system. Police reform will not get us to our goals. And I totally think that at this point, we've seen enough. We've seen multiple police shootings since Freddie Gray. The number has increased. Black Americans are shot at twice the rate of white Americans, even though we only represent 13% of the population, we're 27% of the people who are shot and killed by the police. And all of those things, the culmination of them all, are just reflections of the structural violence that we're dealing with in this country, not just systematically through the criminal justice system, but through every single system in this country, whether it's healthcare or education. So we're not just looking at the police, we're looking at every single system in this country, which has had oppressive outcomes on the health and life outcomes of Black Americans in this country.
Well, Abiyomi Ezekiwi, how realistic do you think that is? I mean, our guest talks about how the system needs to be dismantled, the police system, but I mean, is that even a possibility for it to happen in order to eradicate the problem?
I think it is possible.
I'm sorry, Abiyomi Ezekiwi, go ahead. Sorry about that.
Okay, thanks. I think it is possible. It's a very difficult task, but there's really no alternative to this crisis. And as the United States slowly but surely disintegrates in regard to its capacity to even govern the majority of the people who live in this country, I think people have to start thinking in different directions. And of course, the police are the first line of defense for the repressive state apparatus in the United States. They are the ones who actually feed the prison industrial complex, routine traffic stops, stop and frisk, criminal investigations, racial profiling. This is how people are scooped up, railroaded through the court system, put into the prison system, which is profitable for the ruling interests in this country. So I think there's really very little in terms of an alternative to radical, what may appear to be radical measures. But they are measures that could bring about some stability in the United States, because in terms of the economic crisis that we're facing right now, things can only worsen here in this country.
Well, some of the stats you mentioned there, Joseph Richardson, in terms of how African Americans are more prone to being shot at by officers, and I'm looking at one of them that you mentioned two times, or more than double likely for African American to get shot at. One particular stat puts it at 3.5 times more likely for African Americans for that to happen. The curious thing about this whole thing is there are lots of theories out there, and I shouldn't use the word theory, but there seems to be some who believe that African Americans are being targeted in the form and manner that they are, not just by the police, but in general in society, because there needs to be this white superiority over them. Now, is that going on the edge to ask you a question like that? Is that a reach, or do you see some kind of truth to it?
I mean, white supremacy is pervasive throughout the systems of America, and it's quite ironic that we're having this discussion on July the 4th, which is Independence Day, and we need to look no further than in, at 1776 and July the 4th, Africans were enslaved in this country. This is not a day of independence for Black Americans. And so this has systematically been going on since our arrivals on the shores of this country. I don't think it's a far stretch at all to say where we are in terms of white supremacy in this country. There are a number of studies which document that hate crimes have increased in the past few years. There are a number of studies that have indicated the growth of white supremacist groups, and we need to treat it as domestic terrorism, which we reluctantly up to this point have not. And so I totally would lean towards that this country is in a state where we have to challenge and be very upfront with, we live in a white supremacist society. And until we begin to really acknowledge and honestly and direct our efforts towards dismantling what it really is, I don't think we can make any progress at all. But one thing I would also like to say, even in terms of police brutality, there was only less than a week ago that we saw the case of Randy Cox in Connecticut, who was arrested, placed on his stomach in the back of a police van, and is similar to Freddie Gray, was given a rough ride, which ultimately resulted in his paralysis from the head down. And I'm sure many Americans have seen that video. So this is something that is pervasive in terms of what's happening in African Americans across this country. And we need to really seriously think about how we can dismantle this system in order to achieve true freedom for Black Americans here, or we're just going to continue to be in a perpetual state of oppression.
Hmm. Well, breaking this down in terms of the officers, I don't know if this would apply or not. I'm going to use a case in point from Minneapolis, Abayomi Azikiwe, where many officers, they don't live in the cities and the towns that they patrol. And in terms of the data, it says that only 8% of the officers live in the city. And the people say that because they don't live around us, then they don't know us, then they don't have actually a connection to what some have said to the humanity of Black people, that sense of humanity that the police officers should really care about the Black community. How true do you think that is? And does it apply to other states?
It does. Here in Michigan, in the city of Detroit, which is the largest municipality in the state, there used to be a residency rule for police officers and other civil servants that was eliminated about 30 years ago, and was eliminated by the state legislature. So now you can come from a rural area in northern Michigan where you've had no contact whatsoever with Black and brown people and yet be hired to patrol the streets of a majority African-American city. Detroit is about 79-80% Black. So clearly there's a cultural conflict, and the type of stereotypes that are embedded in policing in general, even among officers of color, they still are taught to view oppressed communities suspiciously as a source of crime and vice, and to go after these people and treat them as brutally as possible. So, no, the training obviously is not working. It's only working to create more repression and more death and destruction.
Last question goes to you, Joseph Richardson. When do you think it's one too many in terms of deaths that will continue, most likely, based on the trend that we're seeing from police killing African Americans, where it's going to tip over and we're going to see some kind of social crisis erupting out of it? We have seen protests. We have seen people come out to the streets, and we have seen violence to ensue. But when do you think that one time is going to be too many?
I think we're already there. I just want to go back to your previous question really quickly in terms of the residency rule. There's actually no data to support that even if police officers who are white live within the confines of the city limits, that would actually lead to a reduction in shootings. Like, there's no data in our study to prove that, to my knowledge, to prove that would actually even reduce it. And in fact, I believe, just in terms of the history of redlining in this country, I believe that white police officers would live in their own ethnic enclaves if they were even living within our cities. So in terms of that reducing the number of police shootings in this country, I don't believe that would have any effect at all. But to your question, when is one enough? That one has been enough since we arrived here, and we were exposed and the victims of the over 4,000 lynchings that have been documented in this country, which is an underrepresentation and underestimation of how many people were killed at the hands of white citizens and a white supremacist government. So until we have a radical change of the system that we know now, that we're experiencing, I think we're just going to continue in this perpetual state of seeing multiple police shootings without much happening.
Thank you for that. Joseph Richardson, Professor of African American Studies and Anthropology at the University of Maryland, and Abiyomi Ezekiewicz, thank you, editor of Pan-African Newswire. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For Mikhail Tavle and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, it was said that Imam Khomeini protested to the ratification of the scandalous bill known as capitulation in the Iranian parliament in 1963. The Imam, in his speech, castigated the parliament and the government, alarming the ulema and the nation against a great danger. Today, we are going to narrate the aftermath of Imam Khomeini's protest and his exile to Turkey. Stay tuned, please. One week after the release of Imam Khomeini's statement against the capitulation bill, the agents of regime arrested him. The Imam, in his statement, had called on the Iranian nation, the ulema, the army, the lawmakers, preachers, university students, and professors to break silence against this scandalous measure. He said, "The Iranian nation must break these chains. The Iranian army must not let such scandalous things happen in Iran and rather call for overthrowing of the government and expelling the lawmakers who have voted for this. The nation should ask their ulema not to keep silent in this issue. It is an obligation on the ulema of Islam to ask the sources of emulation not to ignore this issue. It is an obligation on scholars and teachers of seminaries to ask the great ulema to break silence. It is obligation on preachers to protest against this issue strongly and fearlessly and awaken the nation. It is an obligation on university professors to make the youth aware of what is behind the curtain. It is an obligation on university youth to oppose zealously against this scandalous plan and cause the voice of opposition to reach the world nations through sensitive slogans. It is an obligation on all the strata of the nation to forget their trivial and periodical conflicts and try in the way of the sacred goal of independence and exit from the shackles of captivity." The regime of Shah arrested Imam Khomeini at night as it was scared of people's reaction. Thus, the commandos of the regime assaulted the Imam's house and broke the door and climbed the walls of the house to arrest him. The Imam's wife, Ms. Khadija Saghafi, narrates, "On the night that they arrested the Imam, I was sleeping in a room with a wall next to the alley. I woke up from the sound and row of the crowd. I came out of the room to the veranda. I faced a strange scene there. The commandos of the Shah were climbing over our wall one by one. Almost every 30 seconds, one man would climb over, although the wall was high and there was no ladder. The sound of their gasp had filled the place, showing their anxiety. Suddenly, there was a sound of kicking the door between the interior and the exterior, and it was broken." Lady Saghafi says that at this time, the Imam was performing his midnight prayer. She continues, "The Imam was awake from the beginning, performing his midnight prayer and seeing everything. Then he gathered some things which he would need after the arrest, like the clay for prayer, handkerchief and comb. At that night, the door was broken and the Imam shouted, 'Keep quiet. Do not break the people's door. I will come myself. Why are you acting savagely?' He was speaking so impressively that there was silence everywhere and no one dared to move. Everyone was petrified. Everyone was standing where they were. No one was moving as if
They were all electrified. In those critical moments of the Shah's commandos breaking into Imam Khomeini's house, not only the Imam didn't have the least fear, but he soothed his family, especially his wife. His wife says, "The Imam came to me slowly. I said, 'They arrest you as I said.' He said, 'Don't fear.' Then he took out the ring having his seal from his pocket and said, 'Keep this till you hear from me. Don't give it to anyone else. I put you under the care of God.' I bid him farewell and he went. They were taking the Imam by a Volkswagen and my son Ahmad was running behind the car. Between Ahmad and the car, there were a few agents as the main directors of the operation. Ahmad had chased them while throwing some stones on them, but they did nothing. Ahmad came back and sat beside me. I was lying under my blanket. He said jokingly, 'The lady is asleep.' Although I could tolerate these things, I was very sad. I went under the blanket not to transfer my sadness to Ahmad. One of the personnel of Imam Khomeini's house had related to Miss Saghafi that the Imam had protested the agents of Shah for disturbing the neighbors. The lady says, when the Imam reached the end of the alley, he told them with strong words, 'Aren't you ashamed? Why are you being so savage? Why are you disturbing the people? Why are you breaking the people's door?' One of the commanders had told them to kiss the Imam's hand as a sort of apology. The Imam's wife continues, 'This time too, they took the Imam by a Volkswagen to Fatemi Hospital and put him in a Mercedes there. But this time, they didn't switch on the Volkswagen. They just pushed the car as they didn't want to make this much noise, although they made so much noise that they woke up all neighbors. Anyone who opened the door would face an agent who ordered him to close the door. This was the condition along the way up to the hospital. They took the Imam directly to the hospital and from there to Turkey." Imam Khomeini's wife, Lady Khadija Saghafi, says that some of the agents of the regime felt sorry at their behavior with the Imam and wept. The Imam would calm them. Ms. Saghafi says, "The Imam said that there were drivers in the cars and the man sitting by him would continuously contact Tehran and there were two people on my sides. One of them was crying up to the airport and I was soothing him. He was sad as why he had chosen the job to behave such with a man like me. The Imam came across the Savak chief at the airport. He told the Imam, 'You will go to Turkey.' The Imam told him calmly, 'So much better.' The day after the Imam's arrest, his elder son, Mustafa, was arrested by the agents of Shah. Lady Saghafi narrates, 'The next morning, they detained my dear son, Mustafa, and released him after 57 days. They had proposed him in the prison that if he wanted, he could go to Turkey beside the Imam. Mustafa told me the issue, and I told him that they want to deceive us. It means that you have gone on exile on your own. Moreover, you are more effective in Iran. Try to release your father rather than being exiled. Furthermore, your going to Turkey will decrease people's zeal, and everyone will say, thank God, the Imam is not alone. So he issued a message that he wouldn't go. Thus, they detained him again, and this prevented him from being exiled. During the few days that Mustafa was in Qom, it was clear that he would not stay there as people would swarm and the commutations were different from the previous ones.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB